Good evening and welcome to another edition of Gillespie here on FTRradio.com. I want to thank everyone for tuning in this evening. We have a great show ahead of us. We'll be talking with Congressman Todd Young of Indiana's 9th Congressional District. We'll also be talking with Wayne Siebold, who is the mayor of Marion, Indiana. He happens to be running for the open seat vacated by Congressman Dan Burton, who announced he will not be seeking re-election. Wayne is running for this open seat in the 5th Congressional District of Indiana. And then we'll also be talking with John Brodigan, the bearded one, the bearded Brodigan, getting his view on what's going on in the presidential race. An article yesterday in Politico talking about how, well, the powers that be, they're a little bit upset with how the campaign is going and how Mitt Romney is handling things. So we'll get his take. But we're going to get right down to it. Because unfortunately my sidekick, Mark Warner, he happens to be sick tonight. So say a few prayers tonight for Mark as he is recovering from illness. But I want to welcome my first guest, Congressman Todd Young, who represents the 9th Congressional District of Indiana. Todd is no stranger to this program. He's been on our show when we were on the Hoosier Access podcast, and he is a frequent guest here on FTR. Thanks for being on, Todd.
Oh, it's great. Thanks for having me.
Well, the reason I wanted to bring you back is I recently saw an exchange that you had with the acting OMB director, Zients. You sit on the House Budget Committee, and the president recently came out with his, a week late, mind you, with his yearly budget. And this had to be a joke, right? I mean, that budget is ridiculous. It calls for more spending. It calls for the budget to go, or excuse me, our national debt to go up by $3 trillion. What's this guy thinking? What did Zients have to say for himself?
Well, you know, regrettably, Josh, this is his fourth budget, all right? Mm-hmm. It's also the fourth fiscal year in a row that this president has had deficits in excess of $1 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just wanted to know what exactly the administration's plan, what the president's plan was to address entitlements. Right now, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and interest on our debt, along with a couple of other autopilot spending programs, collectively, they comprise two-thirds of our federal budget.
Mm-hmm.
After another 10 years, we're going to be looking at nearly 80% of our budget spent on these autopilot spending programs.
That is ridiculous.
Well, since they comprise such a large portion of your budget, you would think that the president would propose some solutions to addressing the fact that they are insolvent.
Mm-hmm.
Medicare, for example, will stop paying out full payments within the next decade, according to latest estimates. So I pressed the budget director, Zients, on exactly what their plan was, why they didn't include said plan in the budget. And, you know, as you can see from that little video snippet that I believe you posted on your blog,
mm-hmm.
he really didn't have an acceptable answer. He was reverting to the same tired talking points and trying to run out the clock for my questioning, as the administration always does. So, This is the number one area for those who believe in fiscal responsibility. The number one area where our nation's leaders need to get specific about what sort of reforms they call for, which sort of reforms they support. And the president has been silent for 4 years now. It's time we get some specifics.
Absolutely. You know, the one thing that I've noticed from President Obama is that he can make the big speeches, he can call for the big calls. He did this in September when I can't remember exactly what he was, I think he was talking about the jobs bill. But he was leaning on the House and Senate to come up with a plan. He didn't offer anything. And even though he's offered up a budget this time, he still seems to be leaning on the House and Senate to come up with something resembling a budget that, you know, obviously it's been 1,000 days, over 1,000 days, since the Senate has passed a budget. You guys passed Paul Ryan's budget last year. It got nowhere in the Senate. And that actually addressed real concerns, real needs. Our economy is in the tank, to put it kindly. You know, go ahead.
Our plan would have reduced the size of our debt as a proportion of the economy, which is the main metric that economists look at. It would have done it within the first year. Mm-hmm. So this year, had we implemented what is called the Ryan budget, this year we would have begun to shrink the size of the debt as a proportion of our economy. We would have seen 1 million private sector jobs created this year, 2.5 million private sector jobs every year, beginning in the last year of this decade, had we implemented that Ryan budget. Instead, what the president has given us is we'll call it a budget, because technically I think it falls under that category, but it's really, it's the anti-budget.
Uh-huh.
The president has claimed that he's come up with a plan that would result in $4 trillion in deficit reduction. Clearly, when you look at the details, that statement is false.
Mm-hmm.
$2 trillion of those purported savings have already been enacted in the law, and the remaining savings are derived from gimmicks. The largest of those gimmicks being he claims credit for winding down the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, gets about $850 billion worth of savings from that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, hey, guys, there was legislation authorizing spending
mm-hmm.
for those wars in Iraq and Afghanistan going into the future, so you can't claim credit for that.
Yeah.
But this is the sort of smoke and mirrors that this administration is incredibly adept at. Meanwhile, the president will speak in terms of vague principles, give great speeches. He'll never write specific plans for reform on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And without these sorts of specifics, it becomes very hard to negotiate with somebody, the president or the United States Senate. In the absence of these kinds of specifics, we're left with talking points. You know, I didn't go to Washington just to parrot talking points or to hear them from the other side. I came to lead, to embrace specific solutions, and to defend those solutions. And, you know, I hope we have a president sometime soon that will tell us exactly what direction they want to take the country, and then make the case to the American people, and then implement their plan. That's mm-hmm. leadership.
Well, obviously, the president's his budget called basically for tax increases, for a Republican-controlled House to vote on a tax increase, which we know you guys aren't going to be passing a tax increase, let alone an election year, but in any year, the country can't afford a tax increase. So what can we expect in the House? Obviously, you guys have already taken it up in the Budget Committee. What maneuvers... or what moves? What can we see coming from the speaker, from Majority Leader Cantor, from Paul Ryan? How are they going to address the president's budget, and what do we see coming out of the House?
Well, we won't be adopting much of it.
Mm-hmm.
His proposed $1.9 trillion in tax increases makes absolutely no sense.
Mm-hmm.
His budget gimmicks are definitely not a starting point. So we'll probably start with the last year's budget that we passed
mm-hmm.
out of the House that went nowhere in the Senate. But it was the only plan in Washington,
yeah.
seeing as the Senate hasn't produced a budget in over 1,000 days now. So we'll go through that process, hopefully improve upon last year's budget. Realistically, I don't see our budget getting a vote, or certainly not getting sufficient support there over in the Senate to pass. I don't see the president's budget even getting a vote. In fact, Senate Majority Leader Reid has already indicated that he's not going to put it forward for a vote, probably in light of the fact that last year he put it forward for a vote and the president didn't receive one vote for his budget plan.
Mm-hmm.
So this year, what are we left with? What sort of relief can the American people expect? I regrettably think very little. There's just such disagreement on a range of issues in Washington, fundamental, sometimes principled disagreement about whether we ought to adopt significantly higher taxes or instead set spending priorities and change the way we do business, that I don't know that we'll come to terms before November on these big issues. So we in the Budget Committee, at least I think, are setting the terms of the debate as we move forward. We've got a plan. We're talking in a detailed way now about entitlement reform, something that a year plus ago we weren't talking about in a specific way. So now it's the responsibility of our presidential nominee, whoever that might be, to take up the mantle of this conversation, build on our arguments, and hopefully persuade the American people that a high tax, big spending, big debt approach to governance is not the way to go.
Are we going to be seeing another situation where it's another CR after CR after CR just to keep the government going?
You know, I candidly don't know for certain. I think there will be a strong effort by House Republicans to try and pass for authorizing legislation in our appropriations bills. I don't know that all those appropriations bills will get done, but we'll make a good faith effort to pass as many as we can, just as we did last year.
Sure.
And I suspect that we will pass some of those appropriations bills, which is better than Democrats did when they were in control. And the extent to which we can not just pass the spending bill that we passed last year and then add in a little inflation multiplier, I think that's a great thing. So that's what essentially happens when we pass those CRs. And that's no way to govern. Governing is all about establishing priorities and making decisions, and that's what we stand for.
Sure. And final question before I let you go. You're about to kick off your reelection for your second term in Congress. What has it been like as a freshman for you to experience basically Washington at seemingly its most, their inability to seemingly get anything accomplished? You've been able to experience quite a bit.
At its most dysfunctional, right?
Yeah, exactly. At its most dysfunctional, absolutely. What has your experience been like, and what do you hope to accomplish in a second term?
Well, I think let me start with some of the positive here.
Okay.
We slowed down a lot of the madness that was going in Washington. We, House conservatives, have provided a check on the president's agenda. He can no longer cram through big items like the Affordable Care Act, which he did when he had a majority in the House. He can no longer advance his cap-and-trade scheme through the House of Representatives. And so those are positive things, and I'm encouraged by that. Look, we will next Congress, I hope, if we have sufficient reinforcements, we'll be able to sort of complete the job here. I think repealing the Affordable Care Act is where you start. We definitely need to add to our numbers. We probably need 60 votes in the Senate, or at least to win control of the Senate and also the White House, in addition to holding the House in order to have any chance of that. We need to fundamentally reform our tax code. That ought to be on the agenda. We certainly need to address entitlement reform, so that Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security can be made not just sustainable, but also not pull down the rest of our economy as they continue to grow in terms of their insolvency. That's where you start in terms of your priorities. And then in parallel, there are all the national security priorities that are the most important function of government. I sit on the Armed Services Committee, so we need to make sure that we find efficiencies with in our military, but don't try and manage down any dollar figure arbitrarily, which you get the sense that this administration does from time to time. So I'll be looking critically at those things as we move forward, and always with an eye to keeping the American people safe before you think about budgetary considerations. So those are my main priorities, and there's some in-district job creation, economic development things we can help with as well. And that's why we spend so much time in the districts to learn more about those things.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Congressman Young. You've been listening to Todd Young here on FTR Radio. You can find out more about him at toddyoung.house.gov. You can follow him on Twitter at Rep. Todd Young. Todd, what's the website for your campaign?
www.toddyoungforcongress.com.
Fantastic. Thank you again, Congressman, for being on my show this week.
Hey, Chad. Thanks a lot. Stay in touch.
Absolutely. You've been listening to Gillespie here on FTRradio.com. We'll be right back after these messages.
Conservatives, when you're drinking your overpriced coffee or a Moco Choco, whatever, and the Wacko Latte at Starbucks, you ever feel like you're the only conservative in there? That's because you probably are. But don't feel bad, as you can annoy the bejesus out of those pesky Moonbat, New York Times, and Daily Coast reading liberals by reading HoosierAccess.com. At HoosierAccess.com, you can read the latest thought and opinion from conservatives in the crossroads of America. Annoy the Moonbats at HoosierAccess.com to your favorites today.
And welcome back to Gillespie here on FTRradio.com. My next guest is the mayor of Marion, Indiana. But he's not just the mayor. He's also a candidate for the 5th Congressional District here in Indiana, a seat that was recently made an open seat when Congressman Dan Burton announced that he would not be seeking re-election. Wayne, thanks for being on the show.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, this isn't the first time you've been on the show, but as I was mentioning to you just before before we went live here, is that that this has been rumored to a certain degree for some time that this might be a seat that you're interested in, but you had always backed off. What made you decide to get in this time?
Well, we when Dan Burton decided that this would be his last year and then he was going to retire and it became an open seat, we thought we would take a look at it, and we spent a week really, you know, making a lot of phone calls, and Jennifer, my wife, and I sat down and did a lot of talking about it, and then we did some polling, and, you know, based on a lot of that time, we decided it would be something that we would jump into, but, you know, we just weren't going to do it before Dan retired, because, you know, he had done a lot to help Marion when our some of our factories left early on, and you know, we just were appreciative of that, and we're going to hang out until he retired.
Well, this obviously with the congressman's announcement, it was kind of a packed race to begin with. Once he made his announcement, a few others, including you, got into the race. What essentially is it that separates you from those who are currently in the race?
Well, I think one thing is that, you know, I'm the only candidate from the northern part of the district. And the other thing is, I think, just being a mayor, I really understand the, the importance of what's going on, the decisions that are being made in Washington, how it's affecting people at the ground level, so to speak, and the importance of jobs and how to go after companies that are looking for areas to bring jobs into. We've done a good job with that in Marion, and that's something we'd like to bring to the whole 5th District.
Well, obviously, this isn't your first rodeo in terms of running for elected office. You're a three-term mayor of Marion, the first three-term mayor in Marion's history, correct?
Consecutively. There was a gentleman that was out a few years ago who was in for two times and then out for a while and he came back a third time.
Oh, that doesn't count. We're not going to count him. but you have, I mean, you're very popular up there. And this is a blue collar area, but you've been able to really connect as a Republican with, as you mentioned, kind of a factory town, which is usually kind of a pro-union, probably more Democrat from that point of view, but you've really been able to connect up there. Is it this kind of, the way that you've been able to connect with this group, I mean, how do you see that playing out within the rest of the 5th District? Because the rest of the 5th District, as you know, it seems to encapsulate a lot of different, incomes, household incomes. I mean, you have some of the richest people in the state who happen to live in the 5th District, but you also have some at the lowest end. Also living in the 5th District. You have a whole broad spectrum here.
You're right, and that's one thing I really liked about the district is that it is so diverse. And, I grew up in a trailer court in South Marion and grew up with who worked at the Thompson facility and GM and a paper plate manufacturer, and all those were kind of right around the area that we grew up in. And then, from there, and having the good fortune to be able to skate in the Olympics and then travel around the world and then lived in Los Angeles and produced shows. And, that side of the equation allowed me to really understand what goes on in, the more affluent areas of the country. And, traveling around the world, I've met with, prime ministers and got to meet President Reagan and I've dealt with, a lot of foreign national people in politics that's trade mission trips with the mayor in my mayor's position. So, I really understand the diversity of our 5th district and that's what I like about it. I like the fact that Marion and Anderson and Kokomo and, part of how the Howard County part of the 5th district, we've gone through those tough times and we've been able to turn a lot of that around in Marion. And then you've got the opposite end of the spectrum where you've got, these great cities like Noblesville and Carmel and Fishers and Westfield and those down in the more affluent area of our state that, even though there's a lot of growth and wealth there, they feel some of the same things that we do. And the fact that with that tremendous growth, you got to keep up on infrastructure, which is very expensive and those types of things. So even though we're very diverse, there are some areas we're not that diverse.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned that the area that you currently that you're more that would probably know you better, the northern part of the district, has gone through difficult times. The nation as a whole, obviously you understand this to a great extent, has gone through the last probably 5 or 6 years have been fairly difficult for our country. Just in terms of gasoline, the economy, unemployment, these situations are very familiar with Marion. How do you take what you've been able to do with Marion? Because you have a success story up there. In difficult times, you've helped Marion grow and succeed. How do you take those same kind of principles to Washington, where it seems like everything is just out of control? No one seems to be getting along. There seems to be no cohesiveness in terms of how to approach fixing our economy, approach the unemployment situation. In your experience as a leader of Marion, a town that's gone through difficult times and has survived, How do you take that how do you transfer that to being a member of Congress?
Well, I think we got to take the same dialogue we started in Marion and take that to Washington. And Marion was in that same boat when the factories started leaving our community. There was a lot of strife. There was a lot of bickering. There was a lot of finger pointing. When at the end of the day, it really had nothing to do with the people of Marion. It was just the way the economy is going and the different structure of business and those types of things. And what we were able to do was go in and have a lot of conversation and say to people, listen, if we start working together, if we all start pulling in the same direction in the area of jobs and put a really cohesive plan together, then we have a shot at changing our future. And so some of these things that we disagree on, that don't have anything to do with jobs, let's put those aside for a minute. If we get people back to work, then those things will become much easier to deal with because there'd be revenues coming in that aren't currently coming in because more people would be working. And so we were able to put a plan together. We put our differences aside, and Mayor Leach, who's a Democrat mayor, and I started traveling together, and We bring all of our local elected officials together once a quarter to have a meeting and bring in speakers, and we all break bread together and talk and talk about what's going on in our small towns in Grant County and our larger cities and the county as a whole. And because of that, we've had tremendous success. And then when you start having success, then people start feeling better about themselves and about the area. And I think that's what we got to get to Washington. We got to, you know, Washington has to understand that, you know, a lot of these things that we're fighting about now, we've got to put those aside for a minute and get everyone back to work. And we got to build a plan that makes it easier for business to do business and to hire people. And if we can get that turned around, and then we have all this, you know, quote unquote revenue sitting on the side, then in people, because, you know, once they go to work, then they've got to pay their taxes, which brings in the more revenue. Well, once that starts coming in, then we can start looking at these things that we sometimes have some difficulty with and are having a lot more difficulty with now because there's just not the money to cover all the programming. And in government, our problem is that we seem to let the pendulum swing one way and then back the other. So, you know, one minute we're talking about we've got to make all these cuts, and we do, and we got to make a lot of cuts. But if we don't get people back to work, we got to make tremendous amounts of cuts. And then we'll swing the pendulum the other way, and if we get people back to work, well, then we say, well, we don't need to make cuts because now we have all these people back to work and we got all this revenue. Let's just go ahead and spend the money. And it can't be that way. We've got to start working like business does and say, okay, let's bring revenue in and let's cut. And then you get closer to the middle of you know, what's going to be sustainable. And, you know, government, when we have revenue, we spend it all. And then when we don't have revenue, we figure we got to make all these very drastic cuts instead of really looking at the real issue and working on both of them at the same time.
What has been the reaction to you getting involved in the race? I know that you said that you had done some polling right before you got in. I'm assuming that the reaction to a Wayne Siebold candidacy was fairly positive.
It was. We were pleasantly surprised, actually. I mean, from the standpoint that we, you know, it's funny being in the room and everyone was kind of looking at the numbers and it was pretty quiet. And then someone said, well, you know, with all due respect, Mayor, we didn't think it'd be, as you know, these numbers would be as good as they are, and you know, I sat there for a minute and I said, I agree. And it was just one of those moments where we were looking at it and we thought, wow, if we get into this thing and we work hard and we can raise the money, then we'll have a really good shot at a really good shot at winning this seat.
You actually touched on something real quick there, and as we're coming to the close of the segment, I did want to ask you about that. You enter the race with a little more than 2 months, a little less than 3 months to go in the primary, but two of your opponents have already raised close to $400,000 each. How do you see yourself competing with those kinds of fundraising numbers?
Well, one thing I like to do from my background is I love to compete, and I love a challenge, and I love a short time frame. So, you know, we're just going to get out and work the phones every day and take our face-to-face meetings. And, you know, it's interesting because your whole perception has to change. Mm-hmm. The first day that we were allowed to start raising money, I had commitments for over $40,000. And
wow,
you know, for a mayor's race, that would be, you know, that might be your whole race. So I was all excited, you know, hey, look, you know, and they're like, great, go out and raise 360 more thousand. I'm like, well, that was a punch in the stomach.
Yeah.
And so it was pretty funny. But.
Well, I want everyone to check out Wayne Siebold. You can find out more about him at waynesiebold.com. That is Seybold. You can follow him on Twitter at Wayne Siebold. You can also check him out on Facebook. Donate at waynesiebold.com if you've liked what you've heard. I know I've liked what I've heard. Wayne, thanks for being a guest today.
Josh, thank you. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
All right, you're listening to Gillespie here on FTRradio.com. We'll be right back after these messages. You'll be last to know. Liar's schemes and submachines will hang me from my rope. I'm tired of running from what I was into it.
6 out of 10 Republicans recommend FTR Radio to everyone they know. The other 4... are rhinos. FTR Radio, online at FTRradio.com.
And welcome back to Gillespie. With me this segment, because Mark Warner is sick, is my replacement rhino. And this will be a sort of an Ask a Rhino bit, but John Brodigan, the right hook, is with me this segment. And we're going to talk about, insert adjective here, GOP field POTUS race, whatever. However you feel about it, wonderful, sad, think it sucks. I had something that I had originally written on Twitter, and then I just decided to put insert adjective here because I don't want anybody coming down on me, at least yet. Because I think it's fairly obvious how I feel about this field. It sucks. But anyway, John, I don't know if... Actually, this is... Last time I saw you, it was at the CPACs. You were the bearded Brodigan.
I was the bearded Brodigan. I still am the bearded Brodigan.
Oh, fantastic.
It's my rally beard.
Now, and when you say your rally beard, are you saying that's you're hoping that you keep it long enough, you keep it growing, that maybe the GOP field can come back?
Yes, I'm going to grow the beard until Mitch Daniels gets his balls back from his wife and decides he's going to run.
Well, that's obviously the big story today. Politico had this huge front page, top of the fold, whatever you want to call it, story today. As apparently there is still worry over Mitt Romney. John, are you worried about Mitt Romney? let me put it this way. Let me rephrase that. John, Rick Santorum is leading in Michigan and by a comfortable margin. Are you worried about Romney?
Well, actually, apparently in the last public policy polling poll, Santorum's only leading by 3.
Ah, well, that's big for him.
Happened in Florida, you know, Newt was leading big, and then people changed their mind and went with Romney. But the other thing with Romney that I just saw on Hot Air, I haven't read the article yet, apparently he's only got like $7.7 million cash on hand.
Yeah, well, there was a tweet I saw earlier that he had raised $4.5 million last month. Apparently Ron Paul raised about the same amount. But the tweet I saw was that he only had 1 million, but 7 million would make a little bit more sense, honestly. But that's not good. That's terrible.
Yeah, and especially because I think that's essentially part of the problem, because why are you going to donate money to a campaign when you might lose your home state to Rick Santorum?
Yeah. I mean, it's, I'm sorry. This field is just, it boggles my mind. And I'm sure a lot of people are getting that way. The quotes that were used by GOP state chairman here in Indiana, Eric Holcomb, I'm trying to find the exact quotes here. They were basically that they were beating his door down. Here we go. Indiana GOP Chairman Eric Holcomb, one of Governor Daniels' closest advisors, revealed to Politico that, quote, "the whispers have become shouts. The knocks on Daniels' door have become fist pounding." And a lot of this has to do with the fact that Santorum has caught up to Romney. And that, you know, a guy who has an organization like Romney, I mean, he's been planning for this since 2008 when he lost the race to John McCain. He started putting organizations together, and they've been running for the last 4 years in key states, namely Florida, which is why he was able to, you know, surge in the polls. He had it in Nevada. He's had it in other states. But, you know, even with that organization, even with all the money, you know, he lost Iowa to Santorum. He lost South Carolina to Gingrich. Yeah, he came back in Florida, but he won New Hampshire, but he was supposed to win New Hampshire. And Florida, as I said before, he had the organization, and Newt just started going crazy in Florida. And yeah. It came back and bit him. And so, I mean, I guess the whole presumptive nominee that Mitt Romney is supposed to be, you know, now they're talking about all the candidates could stay in through the remainder of the primary. I know that in Indiana, it's still out on Santorum because he came a few signatures short, but apparently they might be working something out. I don't know. But Newt's on, Ron Paul is on, obviously Romney's on, and he can't put these people away. And these are lesser tier candidates. I mean,
these are a couple tiers beneath them.
So
I don't get it. I'm actually stupefied by this because, look, fine. It's like, you know, even though he was a true conservative, in 2008, he's like the moderate candidate now. It's always the moderate versus the rhino, and you know, all this other stuff.
Yeah,
but people really do not like Mitt Romney to the fact that they're even considering Rick Santorum.
It's true. I mean, I'm no big fan of Mitt Romney. I don't hate him, but you know, the whole flip flopper thing that was going on in 2008, and he still has it now. You can pull up any you type in Mitt Romney in YouTube, and yeah. Flip flop, or Mitt Romney in abortion, Mitt Romney in healthcare, and you're gonna find instances where he supported abortion, where he supported an individual mandate, and then you'll find instances where he's been against abortion and he's against the individual mandate. I mean, people don't know how to trust this guy, and they're wondering, are they going to get a Republican version of Barack Obama?
But, I mean, here's the other problem with Romney's race. It's like, fine, let's say he manages to win Arizona or Michigan February 28th.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at the schedule now, the March 6th.
Yeah, the Super Tuesday.
Super Tuesday?
Yeah.
All right, fine. He's going to win Virginia because Virginia is not on – he's the only one running.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. None of the others got on the ballot.
Yeah. Ohio I can see as a toss-up because that's like a big – and that's like the 63 delegates. But all right, Georgia, Idaho – he's going to win Massachusetts. But Georgia, Idaho, North Dakota, Tennessee, and Oklahoma,
those are
almost given for Santorum.
Yeah, those are.
This is the same Mitt Romney that could not win a single Southern state in 2008.
Yeah, those are blood red states too.
Yeah, so there's really no reason for any candidate to drop out until after Super Tuesday.
Yeah. Basically, and again, what this article on Politico was referring to, or was alluding to, I should say, was that this is going to lead to basically. Or could lead to a brokered convention. Now, you have previously blogged on this, and I believe that we have exclusive audio of John Brodigan talking about a brokered convention. Listen in here real quick.
Well, drop it then.
I haven't.
You obviously haven't dropped it. You're still waving the damn books around.
I understand that.
You understand? You have driven us crazy with this crap.
Yes.
We're sick of it.
Fine.
They're dead. Whitaker Chambers is dead. Alger Hiss is dead. Richard Nixon is dead. Dead! I wish I were dead! Stop it! Stop it! Stop it now! Stop it! For God's sake, stop!
Okay, fine. What?
Stop it!
Let me just say.
No! Shut up!
John, you apparently have had enough of this conversation.
I'll admit that I'm warming up to the idea.
Oh!
Here's essentially my, I haven't counted them, but here are my reasons why, I want to just wild out and get violent when I hear broken convention. One, I think people have been watching, you know, The West Wing too much, and while that looks good on TV, it probably won't happen in real life. And two, and this is the thing that I find most amusing. The same people who are complaining that the establishment is choosing our candidate for us wants a broken convention where the establishment actually does.
Yeah, they legitimately choose the candidate.
Yeah, I mean, so all the whining of like, well, the establishment are listening to the Tea Party in the primaries. Mm-hmm. Well, come to a broken convention, they don't have to listen to you because the only votes that matter are the delegates who are actually there.
Well, see, now here's the funny thing.
Who are all party hacks?
Yes. Well, but here's the funny thing about that. The last brokered convention that we had was in 1920. I can't remember exactly where it took place, but the only reason I know about this is because it happened to involve my relative and future president, Warren G. Harding. Harding won a brokered convention that lasted several days, and actually was not the establishment choice. In fact, he was the furthest from the choice, in all honesty. But the establishment could not get enough votes to get their guy in. And this was post-Wilson, post-war. The Democrats were actually all lined up, ready to go with their candidate. And here comes Warren Harding and wins a brokered convention on the fifth ballot, I believe, and ended up winning the White House.
You know, it's possible. I think the thing with the brokered convention is that all of the establishment types that haven't hopped on the Romney campaign yet or even donated to it have been holding out for a candidate like a Mitch Daniels or Paul Ryan or Chris Christie or Jeb Bush, who are the candidates who could actually, you know, unite the establishment with the more conservative voter.
Mm-hmm.
Ron Paul supporters, if there's a brokered convention, Ron Paul is not going to be the presidential candidate.
No, he won't.
Sarah Palin supporters, if there's a brokered convention, Sarah Palin will not be the presidential candidate, and she'll probably string you along again just because you were too dumb to realize what she was doing that the first time.
Quite possibly. Oh, man, especially if she goes up there and gives a speech like she did at CPAC.
No, but you know that was a great speech. But you know, I had someone. I was talking to someone because I've made the college quarterback in comparison with Sarah Palin, where she was like a blue chip college quarterback that entered the draft a year too early.
Oh,
and I had a friend ask, you know, so you mean she's like Tim Tebow? It's like, well, no, because Tim Tebow's got humility and a desire to improve.
Yes, whereas
Sarah Palin, not so much.
Not so much. Not so much. She's out there just she's content to go out there and give you the you betcha speech, and I mean, she loads it with all the things that you want to hear. You know, Mark and I actually discussed this last week. You know, she'll give you tons of American exceptionalism. She'll give you tons of Reagan or a Reagan-esque imagery, because every candidate or former candidate or the person who wants to make sure that they're still in the limelight somehow loves to use the shining city on the hill that Reagan used.
Yeah.
You know what? Yeah, I know we're a shining city on a hill. I know that we can return to that form, blah, blah, blah. That's all fantastic. Give me something to rally around outside of the same thing. That's what I get when I get Sarah Palin. I know we're not here to talk about Sarah Palin, but I'm just saying it's just in a mini divergence. That's you know, I'm still going off of last week's conversation with Mark, where I was like, you know what, I saw the speech, and I was like, okay, yeah, she got a lot of people cheering, and I'm sure a lot of that cheering actually came from the occupiers who were in there who tried to disrupt the whole thing, you know, and you know she made a couple witty lines, she made a couple of things that you know is like. It was like a butcher in front of a lion pit. You know, here, let me cut off some things, toss it to the crowd. Woo! But there was really, honestly, nothing else there.
Which is fine. I mean, I don't, you know, at an event like this, you're not looking for policy addresses.
No.
The problem is that, you know, Marco Rubio, Mitt Romney, Paul Ryan, Scott Walker, all these other people,
mm-hmm.
you know, you already know can handle their own policy-wise because they've given policy addresses before. They've debated people.
Yeah.
So you know that. Sarah Palin refuses to do any of that, so fine. She gave another throwing red meat to the audience speech.
And that was the capper. I mean, I don't know. I remember last year, you know, Mitch Daniels, he gets up there and talks about the Red Menace.
Yes.
You know, and he wasn't a candidate. But he was a featured speaker, you know, one of the evenings. You know, you had, obviously you had the presidential candidates there. But, you know, I don't feel like you got that kind of, and obviously I'm biased because I'm from Indiana. I love my governor, despite the fact that he refuses, or his daughters and wife refuse to let him run for president, even though he clearly wants to.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's, I don't know. I'm just so frustrated over what's going on. And I'm not one who is going to be lining up behind Mitt Romney just because everybody in my timeline seems to be frothing over the mouth over Mitt Romney. Either they love him or they hate him. I'm indifferent.
I'm absolutely indifferent.
I am too. It's like, okay, so if he's our nominee, fine, I'll vote for him. I'm just not excited about him. But that's the other thing that they made mention in that Politico article, and I think that Santorum actually hit on this note in his speech on Friday morning, was that the fear of having a candidate that no one has any faith in, or no one is even excited about. You know, we had that in 2008. We're preparing to have that again in 2012, even if that is Rick Santorum. And his
here's a problem, though. The candidates that we get excited about are usually too smart enough to not run for president.
Well, just, you know what? Here's the thing, though. Christie hasn't ruled out running 4 years from now. Frankly, I'm happy with him not running this year, because I'm afraid the left would Sarah Palin him, just because he has about as much gubernatorial experience as Sarah Palin did when she ran for vice president.
You know, I agreed with that at first, but when you look to see what we have stuck with now, I wouldn't mind losing the talking point about, he doesn't have experience, and just like Barack Obama doesn't have experience, and let alone the fact he's got more experience than Barack Obama. I would give up that talking point for someone like Chris Christie, because at least people would be motivated to support him.
That's true. I would be motivated to support him. But again, what I don't get is the reason that Mitt is crashing and burning at this point for some reason or another is, one, obviously people aren't excited about him. He is just, you know, not drawing any voters. But the person who's gaining on him isn't necessarily someone who has, you know, the same kind of business experience or the same kind of value system. It's Rick Santorum, you know, who's based his entire senatorial career and his entire career in the House as someone who is a social conservative. And, you know, I'm a social conservative, but I look at where our country is right now, and I'm not exactly too concerned about gay marriage.
But see,
I'm really not.
Here's the problem, and I got attacked. Well, not I got people whining on Twitter. It's like, oh well, you know, Brodigan's saying, you know, you could be a social conservative. Don't talk about social issues. Like, no, I mean, Bob McDonnell, governor of Virginia, is a social conservative. He's pro-life. Mm-hmm. He's anti-gay marriage. He's all the Christian religious-based social issues.
Yeah.
But when he was running for Virginia, he said, yeah, you know, I'm pro-life. I disagree with gay marriage, but I think we need to talk about jobs. And he was smart enough to pivot back to jobs. And he won with 62% of the vote. And I think he still has a 62% approval rating. Rick Santorum not only isn't smart enough to pivot and go back to jobs, he makes unnecessary comments.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, fine, maybe factually speaking, prenatal testing increases abortions. That might be factually true.
Yeah.
You're bringing that up in the presidential race. Why?
Yeah, exactly. But then, you know, they're saying that the establishment, if you will, the power players, or as again, Indiana GOP chairman calls them, the adults in the room, are concerned about Mitt Romney because he too is making just boneheaded gaffes. I mean, well, he didn't use the word term boneheaded, but I mean, it's essentially what the article implies, is that, you know, the power players, the adults in the room, are looking at this field and they're just face-palming all over this thing. And just being like, we had a chance. We have a president here who has increased the national debt by over $5 trillion, introduces a budget that adds $3 trillion to it, you know, has single-handedly taken over the healthcare industry, took over the automotive industry. He wants to take over the energy industry by executive fiat, by going around Congress and going through the Department of Energy. I mean, he wants to do all these things. He's positioned himself to be defeated, and we we can't do anything with that.
You know, the only thing I like about Romney is that he does the least damage to me locally in New York.
Well, I can see that.
Yeah, I mean, Newt Gingrich, and if it's not a competitive race presidential-wise, Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum will still motivate the left to go out just to not vote for Gingrich or Santorum. And if they're not voting for him, they're going to not vote Republican down the ballot.
Yeah.
If it's Mitt Romney, they're not going to be that motivated to vote. So then it's when you come to local races, the local state senate seats and assembly races, it's the matter of getting your own guy get out the vote efforts.
Yeah.
And Romney does the less damage to that. That's literally the only positive thing I have to say about a Mitt Romney candidacy.
Well, you make a good point there. Now, here's the other question I throw at you. VP. I mean, we will hope for the best and that we don't have some sort of brokered convention in August. I know that John McCain swung for the fences by adding Sarah Palin to his ticket because he knew people were not excited about him. He knew it. I mean, yeah. He had to. So, does Mitt Romney swing for the fences himself, but obviously not making... I think we can learn the lesson, I think, from John McCain and not go for a complete unknown who happens just to excite the base and that's it.
But the thing is that there are plenty of knowns who do excite the base.
Exactly. But again, they're also establishment... Here's the funny thing, is that they're all establishment types. They all have their sort of warts that would ward off the base or the Tea Party types. I mean, obviously, Chris Christie, he's not exactly socially conservative.
Yeah.
Mitch Daniels, he had the truce thing, although he has one of the most pro-life records of any governor in the country, but yet he uttered the word truce and said, you know, we should wait. how dare he? Marco Rubio is actually, believe it or not, a career politician. And Paul Ryan, I mean... It's again, but there are things to like about these guys, though. I don't have anything against Paul Ryan. I think Paul Ryan.
Well, no, but the thing is, you know, it's if we want to have a conservative candidate like nationwide, they've got to have conservative principles, but they have to find a way to like verbalize and debate those conservative principles without scaring away independent voters.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that when you bring in someone like a Mitch who has not shut the door on being VP,
yeah.
When you bring in someone like Mitch or a Chris Christie or a Marco Rubio, who frankly I think Marco Rubio has to be a part of any ticket. Honestly, he is...
Not going to happen.
I know it's not going to happen.
I want it to happen. I want to believe. I'm still... My heart's still broken for Mitch.
Well, mine too. But Marco Rubio, he's a door to the Hispanic community. And, I mean, the Democrats have just run wild with that particular demographic, and the Republicans have just sat back. But here's an opportunity, a young Hispanic Republican who can appeal to independents, Tea Partiers, moderates. he could just open that door and not close us off to the Hispanic community for generations to come.
Again, all those words make sense. And
the words put into a sentence, yes, they can make sense.
I understand what you're saying. I mean, I'm encoding it properly, and I agree with your general thesis that you're throwing down.
Yes.
It's just not going to happen.
Well, much like Mitch Daniels running for president, it's not going to happen. Much like Chris Christie running for president, it's not. George Jeb Bush. And frankly, Jeb could run if it wasn't for his stinking last name. I mean, I
so aggravated by that, and especially the people where I like the liberals in New York, where I say I can support Jeb Bush. It's like really ill. It's like, oh, if his last name was like Brodigan or Gillespie, he'd be the president right now.
That's right. That's right. Oh well, I can see we've really gained no ground here, but it's just a discussion that needs to be had. I think, and obviously we'll be talking more and more about it as we get closer and closer to the convention, as we see how Super Tuesday plays out, how the schedule plays out in March and into April. If this thing isn't figured out by May 8th, which is Indiana's primary, I think we're well on our way to a brokered convention.
Okay. Well, I will say that if if Santorum does win Michigan, it's going all the way to Tampa.
Oh, jeez. That's a bold prediction, but that's entirely possible. Prediction.
All swing, right. Swing it for the fences.
That's the way we play here on Gillespie. All right. John, thanks for being our guest this week.
You're welcome, sir.
I want to thank my guests this evening. We had a great show. You heard from Congressman Todd Young from Indiana's 9th Congressional District. We also talked with Wayne Siebold, who is running for the open seat in the 5th Congressional District here in Indiana. We also talked with John Brodigan. Hey, it wouldn't be a Rhino segment without talking to John Brodigan. Am I right? Am I right? Tonight's bumper music was brought to you by Andy Ziff. You can find him at andyziff.com. That is Z-I-P-F. Also, if you happen to be in the Indianapolis area, he will be performing a house show in the Fishers area on March 5th. You can find out more about that at andyziff.com. You also heard from Soul Food 76 and the 5 o'clock people, as usual. Up next is the Snark Factor with Fingers Malloy and the Snark Factor Players. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. You've been listening to Gillespie here on FTRradio.com. We'll be back next week.
Don't speak like you used to. Where do we go to now?